So, Jay, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what keeps you busy?
Well, first I would say my name is a junior, so I had my father's name. I'll be 80 years old in October.
What day in October?
October the 9th.
Okay, I'm October the 13th. So we're close. I will remember that
Libras,
now.
Libras. Libras. I grew up in New Jersey. I was born in New York City and lived there for a while, but mostly grew up in New Jersey. Moved to Colorado in 2001. I'd been commuting there to be with my lady, became my second wife, for about 10 years. And I've been practicing law for 55 years. I'm the sixth generation lawyer in my family, and my son-in-law is the seventh, and my about-to-be-married new granddaughter-in-law, I guess you say that, is going to be the eighth generation. So perhaps that's a beginning.
That is a beginning. So you live in Colorado now?
I do.
With your wife,
right? I do. With Jackie Merrill, my wife, yes.
Okay. And tell us a little bit about what you do vocationally for work and what you've done vocationally for work over the years.
As I mentioned, I practiced law now for 55 years. Very early in my career, I found my interest was in families and not so much their dysfunction, so never litigation. I think I was in court twice in my entire legal career. Really, what causes them to flourish? That's been the interest of this whole life. Started when I was at 4 years old, when my parents were having a conversation, which I overheard. I don't know if they knew I did or it doesn't matter, in which my mother mentioned a proverb called shirt sleeve to shirt sleeves in three generations, and that had happened in her family. And her father had gone effectively bankrupt in the Depression. And from one day to the next, her life changed completely. And so she was worried about money all of her life. And she was worried about the question of a family and flourishing. And when he'd gone bankrupt, some of the siblings kind of turned away from him. I mean, there was a lot of aspects of this I was hearing.
A lot of pain.
Much later, in 1974, I was in Singapore. That's a long story I won't bore you all with today. But a Chinese gentleman looking across the table at me said, "Mr. Hughes, we have a Chinese proverb." And I thought, I have hundreds. I wonder what this could be. He said, "Shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations." I said, "Really?" I said, "That happened in my family." So he and I had a conversation about how he might and his family might avoid that outcome. And let me just say, so because it's about vocation, that when people hear that proverb, they think they're talking about financial capital. The proverb isn't. The proverb is talking about how long a family flourishes or doesn't. So I committed myself in a funny way after that second hearing of that proverb, my mother at four and this Chinese gentleman in 1974, to seeing if I could figure out why that happened and how it could be avoided if a family had the intention to avoid it. That last point is very important because people have intentions about lots and lots of things. They have purposes about lots and lots of different things. Only a very few of them become intentional. And then one perseveres in seeking to bring that or continue to bring that to life. So really my vocation for my entire professional life has been trying to help families who had the intention to avoid that outcome, what I would say have a flourishing fourth and fifth generation of their family, because fourth might be luck.
Yeah.
You get to five, you're probably doing something pretty
important. Yeah, you're doing something right.
Okay, so how's that?
That's great. And then did you always know that you wanted to get into the legal profession?
Well, that's an interesting question about how the universe works. I went to college at Princeton University to study history.
Okay.
Which remains, as far as I'm concerned, the only degree I have that really matters.
And why is that?
Well, you work to be a historian and get a degree in history from a serious university, you really have to love the subject.
That's so true.
You have to do big systems thinking. You have to imagine how lots of different parts come together to create a particular whole. I was fascinated by that, and I remain fascinated by that all my life. I still read big, thick, our audience can't see, but 4 inches thick history books. So as I was about to finish college, I thought, what shall I do next? The Vietnam War was on.
Okay.
It did seem very useful to continue in school. And I thought, well, maybe I'll go to law school. My father was a lawyer. My grandmother, well, as I said, all these generations. But I really went to law school more because I wanted to understand my father.
Wow.
We really had a complicated sort of relationship growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Fathers and sons do. And yeah. Ours were, I wouldn't say more fraught or less fraught. It was just complicated. I thought, I wonder what he does. Other than getting on a train in the morning with a briefcase.
Right.
Coming home with an even thicker briefcase and getting back on the train the next day. So I went to law school and I enjoyed it. But I didn't think it was really more than a job. I thought I was getting a certificate that said, you can do this. Only much later did I realize that the law was then, for me, I was an outlier. Very far on the edge. In fact, the last 20 years of being a lawyer, lots of people have said, but you're not a lawyer, Mr. Hughes. I said, well, yes, I am a lawyer. Oh, but you're really not. You're not doing what lawyers do. I was not interested in litigation, ever. I wasn't interested in controversy. I'm a 9 on the Enneagram.
Conflict, peacemaker.
Conflict is, Oh, please don't ask me to do that.
Yeah.
But mediation of human experience fascinates me.
Mm.
Maybe I could best say that what I found in the law, and have now found even more in this late stage of life, is that true lawyers are basically chiefs for peace.
Mm.
Our real work in the world, our fundamental responsibility, is to help human communities order themselves so they're safe for the people. So they can flourish in them or do whatever they're going to do. I don't mm-hmm. have any opinion what anybody else does, just as long as they don't harm themselves or harm somebody else. But I found in this work the capacity to help order things.
Mm.
Not order in a narrow sense, but order in a sort of very big system sense. So how do you find and create security so people can do whatever they're meant to do?
Mm.
So that's what... So I didn't know that when I went to law school. I thought I'd get a job, which I did get a job, and it's been a good job. But learning to be a lawyer has been, for me, a lifetime experience.
So you, one thing you failed to mention that I will mention on your behalf of what you've done, is particularly over the last 20 or so years, is write some books. Just a couple books that you've written. But one of the main, you are kind of the forefather in a lot of this thinking around family thriving and flourishing. Can you share a little bit about, you know, the first book that you wrote on this subject and what made you want to write it?
Jenna, at the age of 49, right on time, I found myself in Dante's Dark Wood with no way out. An absolute midlife crisis.
Wow.
And a good one.
Yeah.
Now, good midlife crises, as I've come to see with my own and other people's, are very dark.
Mm.
If you survive them, you're different. You've done something very important. You've cleaned out a lot of stuff. Ego becomes lots less important. Solving big problems becomes much more interesting. So as I was coming out of the midlife crisis, I found myself in a very peculiar place professionally. And that was that I realized that the work I had been doing, and I had a very big posture in the world. I mean, big ego. And lots of people say, oh, good stuff. But I found out something terrible, which was part of the midlife crisis, that all the structures which lawyers create, corporations, partnerships, trusts, blah, 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 on and on and on, the only person that could make them work was me. The responsibility of a lawyer is to enable his or her client to do something themselves. It's to liberate them. It's to help them overcome an obstacle. So I found myself in the absolutely worst possible position professionally. Everybody thought I was doing great work all over the world. I was traveling all the time, everywhere. And what did I discover? I discovered the only person who could make these really complicated structures work was me. That was devastating.
Mm.
So I had my dark night of the soul. I sat in dark rooms and tried to figure out how to move out. So as I was coming out of that crisis, I made a promise to myself and the higher authorities of our spiritual world that I would never do that again, knowingly. Like everyone else, I could do it without knowing it.
Right.
But no, I would not knowingly do anything again with a family that didn't free them, didn't enable them to do something, solve an obstacle, flourish. So I began to reconsider the questions. And then I realized, and sort of halfway through the midlife crisis, I thought, you know, I've got to give myself a present to get through every day. But I was not deserving of a present. I was trying to deal with a lot of, seemed to me, errors. So I just said, well, what present could I give myself every day that would make the day at least a little brighter? I thought, I'm going to read again. I had, even as a little boy, I mean, this is sound like bragging, but I was reading big books at 5 and 6. Yeah. I mean, I just have that gift.
Yeah.
So it's a gift. It's not me. It's just a gift, yeah, I had in this lifetime. I thought, I'm going to read. So I began a project of Forrest Gump reading.
What's that? Forrest Gump reading? Explain that to me.
All right. So I'm going to bet that anybody watching has seen Forrest Gump movie once.
Yes.
Okay.
Most likely.
And you remember when his lady love dies, mm-hmm, and he's bereft. Mm-hmm. He says, I think I'll take a run. So he puts on his sneakers and he goes out of the house, that beautiful southern mansion. He says, I think I'll run down to the end of the driveway. And he does. He gets to the end of the driveway. He says, I think I'll run to the end of the road. And 3 years later, he's still running. Remember?
Right. Yes, I do.
And there's a crowd behind him. And who is this man? He's running every day. And finally, he stops. I haven't stopped my reading. It's my Forrest Gump reading. I just keep reading.
You just keep reading.
As I was doing that reading on a lot of subject I knew nothing about, I was re-educating myself. I began to imagine something. And then I began to talk about it, which was really hard because I didn't really know enough about it and I'd never heard anybody else talk about it. I thought, you know, families have a lot more assets to work with in flourishing than they know they have. Hmm. I thought, no, Jay, you can't know that. That's just, it may not be so. But I kept pushing at it, Jenna. I kept pushing at it. I kept thinking, well, wait a minute. Why doesn't a family think that it has spiritual capital? Well, it must have a purpose. If it doesn't have a purpose, it's like Alice in Wonderland. You know, the Cheshire Cat said, where are you going, Alice? She said she didn't know. He said, you're sure to get there. Well, a family that is purposeless, has no spiritual capital, is just going to end up someplace. And the proverb will win. But a family began to see that families that had a purpose, an intention, all the boats would rise, that all their family members would have enhanced lives by virtue of the family. I thought, well, they've got capital. Huh, I thought. Well, what else do they have? Well, they seem to make better decisions than other families. They seem to have a better way of making decisions, which is a social process, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And when people decide to get married, they don't really fully understand, but what they're really committing to is a joint decision-making process.
Mm-hmm.
You give up your freedom to get freedom, right?
Right.
You hope that if I make joint decisions with this person and help them, I hope they'll help me, but I can't know.
Right.
I can only hope, but I know I can help them. So it's a social capital. I thought, oh, people have social capital. They make better or not so good decisions. I thought, that's interesting. Then I thought, well, what other capital do they have? They have intellectual. They're learning. Oh, I thought, yes. The families I was seeing that were flourishing were immense learning systems. And they were sharing what they learned. So they weren't going into some dark corner and learning something and saying, I know something I'm not going to share. No, they couldn't wait to get back to whoever the family, as they called it. And I also discovered, of course, that they were thriving human beings. So there's human capital. So all of a sudden, I thought, well, wait a minute. Financial capital is the least important. Huh. I said, well, I'm sure everybody knows that. You know what? People didn't know it.
Wow.
I was shocked.
And still, it's a learning process
for a lot of— I'm still shocked every day. I'm shocked. Yeah. I say, how can that be? It seems so obvious.
Yeah.
So I began to talk to groups gingerly, very anxious. I was very anxious because I thought, I'm just missing something here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, lo and behold, people say, oh, that really makes sense. I never thought of that. I didn't realize that we're really quite rich.
Mm.
Yes, I'd say you're very rich. So that process is really where I emerged after the midlife crisis. And I've been on the course ever since of trying to figure out, well, what are these capitals? How do we grow them?
Mm-hmm.
The liabilities are sadly pretty obvious. If you don't make good decisions together, guess what? You're Alice in Wonderland.
Yes.
If you don't have a larger purpose, guess what? You're purposeless. Well, that's deficit.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not learning all the time, guess what? You're not going to understand the world you live in.
Right.
If you're not thriving as a human being, healthy, well-being, you're not. And then I also discovered along the way that the word wealth means well-being. It doesn't mean money.
It's a big piece of the puzzle that you helped me uncover
Huge.
Too. Yeah.
Well, that's just in the dictionary, but I didn't go to the dictionary
right.
early enough. Just think of 50 years ago with all that reading and this big dictionary I had by my desk that was my aunt's. It was a poet and my great Auntie Mame, figure in my life. If I'd looked up the word,
mm-hmm.
I would be amazed. So that's my story.
I like it. Now, how many families do you feel like you've worked with over the years? If you had a number. I mean, are we talking hundreds, thousands? What are we talking about?
That's a wonderful question.
I threw that at you because
I was just curious.
It's
a wonderful question. Well, I'm going to answer it in parts because it's the only way I can answer it. When I was a practicing attorney in the first 25 years before the midlife crisis, it was thousands.
Mm.
Very complexly, because I was working with major financial institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, again, without ego, the most important financial institutions in Britain, America, and Switzerland,
mm-hmm.
including their offices in South America, Latin America, Asia. I was traveling everywhere for these institutions. I didn't work for them. I was a lawyer in a law firm. But they were sending me their best clients. And I was essentially providing those clients with the help that they needed to then use the service offerings of those financial institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say in those years, thousands. Also because in that work, they would convene large numbers of families who they wanted to learn something.
Right.
Marketing. I mean, we can be very frank. It's marketing's fine. It's a capital system. And so I would often find myself in front of 200 or 300 people. So we could say each of those were families that I touched.
Mm-hmm.
Then after the midlife crisis, two things happened that changed those numbers radically in the second half. The first thing was that I began to look for opportunities to speak and try out these new ideas. So that was much smaller audiences.
Mm-hmm.
And by and large, the financial institutions sort of said, well, that's not very interesting. You know, we want you to talk about what you used to talk about. Oh,
right.
Really? Well, okay. And then after a couple of very odd things happened, which I'll make short. The first thing was I was at lunch in the year 2000 in New York City in my office. I had a small law firm now of my own with a partner. And a man said to me, Jay, you can't do as a lawyer what you're doing. I said, really? Why? He said, under the ethics of law, you can't represent a whole family. You have to have an individual client. And then you could get waivers from the other, it's okay. I said, yes, but that's not why they're hiring me.
Interesting.
The whole family wants me to help them with this philosophy that I'm
mm-hmm.
writing about
mm-hmm.
and talking about. They want to try it out. He said, well, you can't do that. Your malpractice insurance doesn't cover that. So I went home and thought about it, and I thought, well, that's terrible because I'm putting all my employees and my partners and young lawyers at risk if I make a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
So on a Monday morning after that Friday lunch, I went into my younger partner, and these were all my clients. The capital was mine. He was a wonderful guy, but very much my junior in the right sense. And I said, Warren, the firm is yours 1 year from today.
Wow.
His eyes got, what? I said, yeah. I said, this is what's happened. And the clients are all yours. I'll leave my capital in so you can operate. And he said, well, what are you going to do? Wonderful question. I said, you know what? I'm going to see if I can find a dozen families who would be interested for 10 years in practicing what I've been writing about to see if it's legitimate.
Wow.
So, you know, if we think about it, if you come up with some good ideas, mm-hmm. by the way, Arlington and Ken and I are now joined at the hip by now at this moment. So yes. This is our world. Ken and I began our world after my midlife crisis.
So okay.
This is part of the second, which is the wonder of what I healed and then yes. the people who showed up, just like you today, Ms. Danae, just like you today. Otherwise, I would never have met you.
That's true.
The wonder, isn't it?
It is. See?
So I thought, as a social scientist, and we are all scientists in some sense, I suppose, how do I know if what I'm writing about is legitimate? Yes, there are lots of people in audiences who say, oh, this is remarkable, wonderful stuff. Woo, wow, great. But I thought, yeah, but does it work?
Mm-hmm.
Is it practical?
Yeah.
Can you practice this? Would it help the family flourish? Grow what I call its affinity?
Mm-hmm.
So I said for a year, between 2000 and 2001, I'm going to see if I can find a dozen families that would commit to me for 10 years. And that's all I would do. I might do a few boards like this one and a mm-hmm. few others, but I wouldn't take any other clients. I would just commit myself to whatever were the issues that that particular family. And lo and behold, at the end of the year, I had 11.
Wow.
Now, you see, here's another one of those errors. This is human life. I committed to 12. To whom? To myself. Nobody else.
Yeah.
But I had to have 12. Of course, it was completely specious.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, there's this one family that really want me to do this, but I'm not sure. But I have to have 12. So 1 year later, they and I came apart. The other 11 stayed with me for all 10 years.
Okay.
And I discovered that these ideas work.
Yeah.
That if you actually enable yourself to ask every day, where are my capitals today?
Mm-hmm.
Where's my spiritual life? Where's my social life, my intellectual, my human? Is my financial supporting those, not leading them, mm-hmm. not reducing them? Is it supporting them? Is it a foundation for growing those? Ah. And as the families came to talk that way, talk about wealth as well-being, not as money, amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, yeah, this works.
Yeah. And that's how that's amazing. I actually didn't know that. And that's so interesting. The first, how you really bifurcate, if you will, the first part and the second yeah. part of your journey. And so I guess that leads me to Arlington, right? So how did you get connected to Arlington in the latter half of your career?
Well, there is a certain destiny. Fate and destiny have always fascinated me, Jenna. Fate seems to be very negative.
Mm.
Destiny is fascinating. One of the things that I made a decision to do in the early, even in the first half of my life was to live my life based on synchronicity and not serendipity.
Mm.
And the way that worked out is that I committed myself to anybody who wanted to see me, I would spend an hour with. Never at their expense. Always
wow.
entirely free. And by the way, I never took a client other than maybe the first 15 years when I didn't know any better, where the first two meetings weren't on me. I didn't want to be committed. When money moves, things change.
Right, totally.
I didn't want to be committed to that person until she or he knew, well, could we help them?
Right.
Okay. So one day, I got a telephone call from one of Ken's earliest friends and earliest parts of Arlington, Spencer, I want to say Smith, but it was Spencer something.
Mm-hmm.
This guy calls me up. He says, we'd like to come and see you. I said, well, who are you?
He said, helpful question.
He said, well, the guy I'm working for, Mr. Polk, and I are down here in Birmingham, Alabama, and we have an idea about how we could help families, and we've heard about you. I said, really? You want to come all this way?
Huh.
Come on. Really? Yeah, come on. You must be, you know, at first I thought, well, this is a silly call. And I said, well, look, if you really want to come all this way, I'll be happy to spend an hour or two with you, but it seems just an awfully long way. So Ken and Spencer and Bill, oh gosh, it's an awful, my memory is not
this
as good as it was.
This was early on in Arlington
but
days.
The first Ken's first partner from the accounting firm, William, it'll come to me, who was the first partner of his at Arlington, where Arlington was born, out of that accounting firm. These three young men, very young, showed up in my house in Aspen and sat on the couch. And I sat in my chair and we talked. And I thought, you know what? These are interesting fellows.
I can only imagine.
I thought Birmingham, Alabama, and accountants. Really? So I listened and probably pontificated like I am today, for which I apologize to our audience.
No, it's all good. It's all good.
And at the end of it, they were big eyes. Oh, this might work. But it's a lot more complicated than we thought. But yeah, this could work. So Ken went back with Spencer and William, and they came next year. And so a tradition began, and for many, many years, until we got too big.
Right.
They would come once a year to my office in Aspen and sit with me for a day. We'd have a nice meal, maybe the day before or that evening, and talk. And it's been, be very careful not to go into tears here, Jenna, but my relationship with Arlington, with Ken, with the partners, with the clients, now with you, has been one of the greatest, greatest gifts of my life. Purposed people, high intention people, are the rarest of people, and without ego.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. That is so beautiful.
Well, that's what we seek to do every day we come to the office. Those of us who are committed to a life of service, is we leave the ego at the door as best we can. Of course, we have ego. We leave it at the door best we can. And we serve the needs of that group of people that we are privileged in our lifetimes to give our service to. You may recall at the beginning of our, we weren't here, but I, on Thursday night when we had our first dinner, I always am given the responsibility and very much the honor of getting on my feet at the very beginning of the first dinner and saying a few words. Sometimes it's welcoming a new partner, which we could do. Sometimes it's the sad reality of acknowledging, as we did this time, that the of our former advisory board member's husband died. We acknowledge that. However, at the end of those little few minutes, I always ask us to raise a glass to our clients, who are the means by which our life of service, seeking to help families flourish, is enabled. It's the honoring of our clients that is the core of our work at Arlington. And as Ken and I have said from the beginning, we get to do in our lives the thing we most want to do only because these wonderful people honor us. And even more importantly, people like you join us. We hope we're positively attracting in the right sense. We're hoping that we're putting out energy about what it could be to help human beings and families flourish that is positively attracting to people who say, oh, that's an interesting profession. Like, can I come help? Yeah, well, come along if you're really interested. So, yeah.
And what do you see as, you know, you've been around Arlington for lots of different variations and iterations and growth. And what gets you excited about the future of Arlington to kind of close our time here together?
Well, if we go back to the very beginning of our conversation and the shirt sleeve proverb, if a family really has the intention to avoid Mother Nature's edict that family will only last three generations and pull apart, that's a very courageous decision to try. You can't make that journey alone. You can't. You have to have, along the way, a few, not just people, but institutions. But institutions, of course, are no more than the people in them. But institutions in a very, very fluid way, not some large bureaucratic, no, something fluid and flexible that walks along with you and that has its own goal of being at least 100 years old. Because if you think about it, Jenna, to get a first hint of how a family's doing, you probably have to get halfway through the third generation's life. So if the grandparents have a dream, my parents did, both kids of the Depression, as I said, my one was bankrupt, the other was injured in the First World War. They, when they got married, my parents, they committed themselves to growing family. So I've been growing up in that soup.
Mm-hmm.
But you really only know how you're doing about halfway through the life of the third generation. It's about 100 years down the path.
Yeah.
And then you get a glimpse. Well, to get to the fifth generation, as I was saying before, you got to know 100 years. The commitment of Arlington's partners that they will walk with the families we serve for those first 100 years and then for the second 100 years is a remarkable commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it so privileged to be a part of it. That's an inspired aspiration. I'm using big words. But you can't do really, one can't do really important things and first one has an aspiration, an imagination of something. And it has to then inspire you, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And then there has to be 100 years of perspiration.
That is the perfect way to think about that. Well, thank you, Jay, so much for all of your thoughts and your wisdom. And just, it is a privilege to get to sit here and talk to you and hear more about your story and your life, and then also just the impact that you've made on Arlington. So thank you from the bottom of my heart, but I know from the rest of the team as well. So thank you.
It's just been pure joy. Thank you.